Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365Copilot.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is a Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back to part two. I just want to add a few little points before we get into this discussion with Matt Williams. You know, I really appreciate everyone that listens to this podcast and people that are providing input and feedback to me. I really appreciate the community that's been around me here. It's really allowed for a lot of opportunity for me specifically, so I thank you all for that. I try to be as communicative as possible with folks that do reach out to me. I would ask anybody who listens to this podcast, please go in, give it a 5-star review. You know, I appreciate the feedback, topics that you want to hear, things that you want to, you know, discuss in greater detail. I'm always open to that. I've got some plans for upcoming podcasts that I'm working through. I am traveling quite a bit, so I hope people recognize that, you know, me doing these every single week, providing that level of content and information is, you know, it's time consuming for me, and I want to make sure that the content is valuable, and hopefully you all gain from it. And that's really the objective. So think about that if you do communicate with me. And, you know, ways that you can approach or ways that you think that I can approach things better, I'm always open for suggestion. A couple of things I want to start off with before we get into this podcast is, you know, I really feel like, you know, there's a lot of discussion around regenerative agriculture in this space. And I'll talk to you about it just a very simplistic way. One of the goals we have is creating these environments that, you know, animals and humans and all sorts of insects thrive in. And, you know, there's kind of some framework that we need to think about. And it really starts with food. You are what you eat. What you eat affects you as a person. It's the same thing applied to animals. And so one of my tricks on my landscape is creating these, and we talked about the refractometer and its measurement of total nutrient levels. But one of the objectives is if you create more food in abundance that fills the deer up, it's less likely to move away from that particular property. So it's critical to think about the things that you're doing and the bigger picture behind it. And their genetic expression is really kind of based on the minerals, vitamins, fat, and oils in the food that they eat. And sometimes we think if we throw out, like for example, we throw out like some type of mineral on the ground, it's not as easily digestible by the animal. And plants really help to balance that nutrient or that energy within the animal. And so throwing something on the ground, or I said before, the bug in the jug, really doesn't provide any real benefit to our animals a broad scale. So we need to think about getting the nutrients into the plant and the plant and the animal. That's a system of success. That's kind of how it works in a natural course. The other thing I want to mention is, you know, I haven't got any criticism on this, but I'm going to be critical of myself. I have really started dialing a process on how to fix soils, and I've evolved tremendously over the past several years. I've gotten much more engaged and intelligent around this topic, and the science is still out, right? There's no one size fits all. They're still learning so much. We know so very little about the soil and how it should be managed or what's ideal. And so the other piece of it is buying good seed. And two things I want to talk about. Buying good seed is important. So I get tons of inquiries. Where do you get your seed from? What do you do? Well, if I could grow my own seed, that's probably what I would likely do. And there's been instances where I've let volunteer seed kind of express itself on the landscape from prior plantings. But I would suggest, you know, buy from a local seed source that you have some history with. You know, they could be organic or not, ancestral blends, what have you. And then buy from a resource that's within your region, but kind of outside your range, so to speak. And look at those two seeds, weigh them, and compare the size of them. Now, see, there's going to be seed variation every single year, but, you know, take note of that and just start to develop kind of this familiarization with other resources. Because I think a lot of the seed that we get isn't the greatest. And we've talked about this on the podcast, is putting the seed in the best circumstance so you can manage at least the soil, the inoculation, the microbiome. You can manage those things in and around the seed, but the seed source itself will vary. And organic doesn't mean it's always better, and tillage isn't always wrong. And so I want to make sure that people understand that some degree of tillages, you know, to incorporate amendments on the landscape are critical. And it's just important to not exceed your organic material levels when you're tilling. That's kind of the rule of thumb that I typically use with clients. And we want to make sure that when we're building these soils, that we don't degrade them. And regeneration means that we're getting back to nature and we're essentially renaturing the landscape for opportunity. And opportunity could be in our degree or in our focus, more opportunity or more interest by our beloved deer. The last thing is fertilizer is not the best way, and it stops nature from functioning naturally. And so I want you to keep that in the back of your mind. And maybe take the term fertilizer out of it, but non-organic or synthetic, basically fake nutrients that are in a form of energy that doesn't necessarily coincide well with the microbiome, isn't necessarily the most, I would say, ideal input. So think about that when you're coming up with, you know, your plans this year for food plots, et cetera, because we're kind of in the swing of those things. And I just wanted you to all be mindful that I'm sorry to add more dialogue to the beginning of this, but I want you to start thinking about some of the things that I'm thinking about so you'll be better apt when you're out there in the field making some decisions. All right. Well, here's Matt and I.
So we know if I say flora or I say fauna, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Life is categorized into a couple different groups, right? Flora, fauna. Well, there's a third category. It's called fungi. And everything on land, in underwater, marine systems too, depends on fungi. It is the base. It is the foundation of the pyramid, right?
Yep.
And so it's gaining more and more international support as something worthy of protection. There are 16 times more fungal diversity than there is plant diversity on this planet. Okay? When you're bringing in those mycorrhizae and those soil inoculants, you're introducing invasive species from somewhere else. Everything you need for those vascular or vascular mycorrhizae, the ones you're going to use in your plots, right? VAM, or what they call VAM, also known as AMF, arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, those already exist on your landscape. And if you Google Korean farming, right, you will quickly learn that you can boil some oatmeal in your kitchen and put that oatmeal inside. Do you know what a suet cage is? A little wire cage, put a suet block in for birds?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so you can take some oatmeal that you boil in your kitchen, put it inside a suet block, go find a spot in your woods where there's, you know, lots of forbs growing, and just kind of move all the ground cover off to the side and set that there. And within a couple of weeks, it's going to be completely colonized with the local arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. Now you can let that air dry and just throw it in a blender and disperse it. Bam, you just inoculated your whole crop, right? That's how easy it is to make this stuff. When you buy mycorrhizal inoculants or soil inoculants, you, unless they're coming from the state of Oregon, which is very adamant about testing the quality and the claims of those products, right? If they're not produced in Oregon and they haven't been subjected to those regulatory agencies, then there's probably less than 0.1% of what you're actually seeking in there that's viable.
Yeah.
What we know now about mycorrhizae is that 0.001% of what we perceive, or sorry, what is in the landscape that we know of, which is only a fraction of the total fungi, but 0.001% of them lend themselves to cultivation. That means that you're leaving out 9,999 other mycorrhizae that can't be cultivated or construed using those traditional methods. Now, if you use oatmeal method, it'll work for whatever it's worth. I serve proudly on the North American Mycological Association's Education Board, and I also participate on the Stewardship Board, and now the committee, rather. Now, the thing is that there's a wave coming. And it's going to hit all the conservation across the whole world, especially here in the United States too, where we have to use fungi as a base parameter for conservation, right? So when this is a field that's just starting to emerge right now, there's not even a ton of language yet to describe our actions. And of course, like all sciences, no one agrees on the exact route yet. So it's a lot of groping in the dark still. And I'm lucky enough to kind of sit on the forefront of this for whatever it's worth. But so when we're using these primers to identify our habitats and, you know, kind of take stock of the value of them, what should stay, what should go, we should really be thinking about, you know, these complex mycorrhizal fungi that are giving our trees resistance. You know, my area where I'm at has been wiped out with oak blight previously.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a number of trees that are 4 foot plus around that did not succumb to them. Or they showed signs of oak blight for a year or two and even looked dead temporarily. And then within a year bounced completely back. And that's because of those mycorrhizal fungal networks, because they are able to deliver, and essentially medicine, on demand to these trees. Does that make sense?
It makes a ton of sense. And so let me bring up another point, and this is getting a little bit outside of the box of what typically we talk on this podcast. But, you know, I go to a lot of properties, right? And I've been in the past, I don't know how many properties, but in the past many properties that I've been on, there's been, you know, some forest management techniques come in. They come in there with really heavy equipment and they're, you know, they're in destruction mode. And when I say I mean, it's a chaotic, in some case controlled, and some cases is disorganized. So they go in big machines and a lot of these, you know, big feller bunchers. And so I get to see these properties years after when they're lacking success, you know, going in and just remediating those areas where a big machine goes in. So I like this concept called soft harvesting. And this is why they run over the sticks. I mean, it's a smart way to do it. But even going in and doing that with lighter equipment as well, and mm-hmm. being more, I want to say, like remote, where you put your equipment, where you select your tree cutting, how you remove timber, all that whole philosophy around that.
People knew how much soil compaction actually affected things, they would stop using heavy equipment.
All right.
So, if you go and mm-hmm. grow a garden, do you know what a broad fork is or a Grinlinette? Are you familiar with this tool?
Yes, I just,
okay.
I am. Yep.
Okay, perfect. So, you know what soil aeration and getting water and oxygen pockets does. Okay, if you broad fork a bed and you grow, you know, let's say a tomato plant in that, and you just your weight of your body go in and walk around that tomato plant inside that bed, you'll have half the yield on that plant that you will the rest of it.
Half. And compaction means, so here's my point, Matt, to this whole conversation. On all these properties that I've been on, where there's been this, I'll just say, misuse or mismanagement of equipment, and you go back 5 years later, the areas where the equipment wasn't, where they cut, versus the areas where they did cut, and cutting both areas, but one where there was a heavy piece of equipment on there, it is night and day difference in the regeneration. I mean, it is so different that you wouldn't even understand what happened in one area versus the other without seeing this. I've been on multiple properties. This is not a eureka. This is not a moment for me, but this is just sitting there and saying, how do you remediate this? And what they've done is they destroyed some of these fungal connections, I believe, in the soil, what has disrupted opportunity for the plants to regenerate. And it's going to take eons, and I don't know what eons exactly means, but it's going to take some time. You're better off starting to build soil at the top layer versus remediating underneath because of the destruction that occurred potentially. So, you know, and this is where you need to focus on biology to fix. And some cases here in the Northeast, with my clients, I'm focused on increasing fertility, then we focus on biology. And in these cases, you need to focus on biology before you can get to adding fertility because you have a compaction issue. Does that seem to
100% makes sense? And that's where, you know, things like daikon are beneficial to what we're doing, you know, because they loosen up the hard pan. But even, you know, kind of one further there, I mean, you know, running over the sticks, all that stuff makes sense too. But boy, if people understood that your soil test only shows you about three things, it shows you your boron, your zinc, and one other trace element accurately. Everything else is just kind of ballparky. And it all depends on the lab, right? Soil biology trumps chemistry every time. I don't care who you talk to. You dig deep enough, you're going to find it out pretty fast. If your soil is alive and active, there's plenty of nitrogen in your soil. Except for some extremely rare cases, there are more than enough phosphorus in almost every soil. There's more than enough potassium in the soil. It's availability. And if your soil's biology is working right, it's mining that and bringing it up. Right. And then storing it, you know, in the dead tissue to be nutrient recycled. But if your soil biology is crap because you basically torched it to death with 2,4-D repeatedly and then ran all over it with heavy equipment, and you're scratching your ass going, well, I need more fertilizer. Well, that's, you know, you've shot your foot off before you even got started. Right. And you're treating symptoms, not the root cause.
To speak. You know, this is another topic so I got a call 2 days ago, client. I'm getting questions all the time, which is good. It makes me think more. He's putting on a product. I can't remember who has that product with calcium chloride. What's the name of those guys?
I don't remember. I'm familiar with the product, but I haven't used it.
Yeah. Well, I don't use it. And so I said, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to Google that product, then I want you to Google the ingredients, right? Don't let me tell you this story. So see what they use the product for. What do you think they use that product for in the street? So like a common use of calcium chloride, what do you think they use it for?
I know what they use it for. They use it to melt snow and to keep gravel roads from being dusty.
Highly toxic chemical and used in an overabundance. And I can't think of the company's name, but it's these... All these guys promote this, and I'm saying to myself, the ignorance here. But again, bug in a jug, there's the bug in the jug mentality, so we've got to get past that. So don't use that product, whatever it is, bad idea. And then, you know, same thing with potassium chloride. What I'm getting at is simply this: you're putting toxins on the landscape, and you have to figure out, and this is what I did with my clients recently. I just built this packet. Now you've got this, you know, this chemical tree to think what is going to work on my landscape of where I do have a deficiency. And to your point earlier, once you get the biology going and you get your calcium and phosphorus levels, you know, to a point where they're functioning correctly, that, you know, they're taking as much landscape as they need to in the soil. What I try to get to is I start seeing the BRICS levels start to go up and up and up and up and up. And guess what? That's a winning combination.
Feed your soil sugars, because that's what your plants are doing.
Exactly.
So all plants are just a sugar factory. That's what photosynthesis is, sunlight to sugar. They trade that sugar to the soil in the soil economy for everything they need. Plants can't take water up from the ground. They can't absorb any nutrients up from the ground. It's all their fungal partners. Fungi are sugar whores. Right? For lack of a better descriptive word, that's exactly what they are. They sweat themselves out for sugar to the subservience of plants, so to speak. So feed your soil that sugar and give it a boom, an economy. And the simplest way to do this is just water and molasses. That's why when we make compost teas and we use molasses for the bacteria to get the exudates from them, yeah, those exudates are wonderful. Don't get me wrong. But really, most of what you're doing when you apply that to the soil is giving, you know, some sugar to your mycorrhizae and giving them a boost.
Yeah.
So you can skip the compost tea and just dilute some sugar and some water, more or less.
Yeah.
And one of the very best things you can do.
Well, and I'll tell you, this is what I just did. So I bought, and I probably said this on the podcast, so I'm sorry for the redundancy, but you know, my theory at this point, and I try to drench the soil with that concoction just alone, like we're talking about, with a few other little additives to it. But generally that's a good concoction. I have a giant 300-gallon sprayer now that I can pull behind my tractor. And again, timing is correct, but now I'm creating all trail systems so I can literally hit, you know, all the flowering plants, all the vegetation, everything in these corridors, and I'm feeding the biology and releasing, in this case, the limited phosphorus that may be on my landscape. And then I'm still doing some additive, my sea salt, C90. And by the way, I sent a message to Ellinger today. He uses Harper's Growing Solution chemicals, which I think are fantastic, by the way. But C90, again, if I was down in, I think I told you I was down in the Caribbean on vacation, you know, you could see kind of the salt mining operations that they have. And really, they've come out with a couple new foliar sprays that I'm super intrigued with. And I just sat today, I was in a conference call earlier, and they were kind of going through all the details of the new products that are coming out. And it was a great Q&A, really bought into some of those products. Now you can find some variation of those from other resources, local mines, et cetera, you know, some of the ancient sea salt. But there's some cool stuff that's coming out of these different markets where they're really trying to focus on some of these fungal connections and, you know, disease resistance within the soil profiles, because they know the wave is coming. We're starting to see this demolition of tree species, and they're wondering what the cause of it is, and they've got to increase health. And sometimes it's just starting with, you know, the sea.
It's a biomass issue.
Yeah, sea energy. And sea energy is a big piece of, you know, using sea energy as a resource on the landscape. And I'm huge into that. Like, I'm a huge advocate of it. Like, I heard somebody talk about biochar. Biochar is the fix. Now, listen, I make biochar, but I energize the biochar, and a great way to energize it now is with this new C90 product that's coming out that's a spray-on. So I can add to my biochar, which I've already done before, but I can do it in a form where I can just buy it. I don't have to create it. So anyhow, so I'm suggesting people think about these things much differently. And this is, I'm sorry, this may be complex for folks, and I apologize, but again, the level of, I think, awareness here is far greater than I think most people that are trying to do this. And the reason being is you're in a tough to hunt area, you got to do everything right, and you've got to try new stuff because you got to be on the cutting edge of success here. And I think Matt, that's kind of why we're friends. Go ahead.
I would like to add one caveat here. I'm using one really awesome product called Sarda. That's my fertilizer. That's my everything. No joke about it. I'm buying a little manure spreader to run behind my foliar, and I'm just flinging Sarda. Because once you get the soil going, this whole thing, all the forest around us, all the soil is driven by decomposing wood. And when we log, we're taking biomass off of the property, right? And so the forest has spent how many ever hundreds, thousands of years mining all that stuff from below our feet, and it stores it in the tree trunk and in the tips of the trees and the branches and in the leaves, et cetera, right? All those minerals have spent all that time and energy making sugar to trade for is all stored right there in that tree. And when that tree leaves on the back of a truck, all that biomass that goes with it has all of those nutrients, right? And so they're not getting replenished and recycled. Now, I can get wood chips and wood fibers, you know, sawdust, stuff like that for pretty much free all the time because there's so many little sawmills around me and things of that nature. And so that's what I use. 100%, this whole forest ecosystem runs on coarse woody debris, whether it's a whole log slowly decomposing, creating habitat and the basis of a food web, or even just little sawdust and wood chips that are doing the same thing on the forest floor and getting that soil, instead of it being a fat, lazy soil that just, you know, gets stuff applied to it and it sits there like a glutton, it works for it. It mines it. It breaks it down. Now I'm getting it lean and fit like a Rocky montage.
Yeah. You know, one thing I want to mention is I hooked up with the local DOT. There was guys just down the road taking down timber, and I stopped traffic. I got out of the car. People probably hated me. I went over to talk to the DOT guy. I said, what are you doing with that load of wood chips? And he's like, it's spoken for, right? And he goes, so this is the beauty of it. So I'm talking to him, and I said, hey, I'd like to sign up for wood chips. He's like, let me get the paperwork out. So traffic, I went over, we filled out the paperwork. The cars are beeping, waiting for me. And just about a week ago, a gentleman stopped by my house, and he was looking at like a landing site for all these wood chips. And he goes, you're going to have to call me when we stop. But when we start, we're not stopping. I said, I will take, and I'm clearing out this large area of my property, I will take every dump load that you had. I mean, there are certain species that I said I wouldn't prefer, but, you know, beggars can't be choosers at this point. Again, free resource, right? And so, you know, I'm going to use it for multiple purposes on the landscape, and we need to do a podcast on just using, you know, wood chips on your property. That would be a great, there's a lot of layers here to this discussion.
Yeah.
But I think, go ahead.
You know that I make my own amendment, so to speak. I use, you know, drywall mud, gypsum, as my calcium buffer for fish emulsion, for example.
Yep.
You know, a tiny infinitesimal amount has a lot of calcium in it. All right. So, and then, you know, I use Epsom salts and so on and so forth. So I've always kind of done my own concocting as an organic farmer because these products are expensive. And if you break it down to base ingredients, it's all relatively cheap and easily affordable. This is how our grandparents did it, you know?
Yeah, I think that's kind of important to look at, is a simpler way to do things that it doesn't really kind of revolve around buying something from a magazine. And I've noticed this, and this is bad of me to say this, but a lot of people are very gullible. And there's a times where I'm gullible myself. And that skepticism sometimes goes a long way when you're saying there's no way that this functionally... You know, humics, that's the other thing. There are variation in how they create humic, and you have to be very, I guess, aware of the resources, the concentration of those resources when you're buying stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I get really weary of certain things, but I have realized that, you know, there's actually, you know what I'm going to recommend for everybody? Buy the great magazine, Acres. Acres USA, they've got a great magazine. I'm a subscriber to it. There's a ton of good stuff in there. There's a ton of resources. John Kemp, who's been on this podcast, he's the editor. I think they do you can do a hard copy, magazine copy, or you can get a digital version. And actually, I think they have a read along and maybe some discussion as well. So you can really, for a membership goes a long way with them. I think that would be a good resource for people because they talk about new concepts and ideas that are really kind of that bio-ag kind of world. And that's kind of where I live a little more frequently than not, Matt. And I don't know, sure. That's just another resource.
Did you go to the Acres? Thomas?
Yeah, Thomas. I think I'm going to go back. I think
awesome.
And here's the other cool thing. So I just bumped down. I met Harry Green, another guy who's just south of me in Ithaca, and I just picked up two pallet or buckets full of Jerusalem artichokes. And so,
oh yeah, you'll never have to buy food again.
Never have to buy food again. Yeah. Huge resource for deer. Great pollinator. I mean, the deer hammer them and the bulbs. And so I just, you know, I'm just way more conscious of my layouts. Now I'm like, all right, I got to have that interior food layer. And by the way, the product that I'm going to come out with here in a couple of years, it's a resource for people. It's going to be that food layer interior to a cover layer that I think we need in abundance. And I'm just trying to create these opportunities where people, and again, I'm not a product guy, that's not my business, but I want to have resources for people where they can take major benefit. It's got to be simple and easy. If I can stick it in the ground and it grows, that's a product that I want. And to your point earlier, I want simple additives. I don't want these complex. I got to be careful because I keep talking about complexity, but I want these solutions that are more understandable to people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes 100% sense. Yeah, it's what I love about, I hate selling mushroom spawn because I feel like a seed salesman, and I really kind of look down on seed salesman types.
Yeah,
right. They treat people like they're gullible public or whatever. But at the same time, you've got to do something to support your work in this, and that's why I do sell mushroom spawn, so to speak. And I get what you're saying exactly. You can't overcomplicate it, and if it's too complicated for you to understand what's on the package, you better make sure that the person who's making it or selling it actually understands what's in it too. I don't think they even know.
Well, and that's the other thing is, how do you dummy proof a system that can be easily fooled? I kind of got to the point in life where, where I'm doing these layouts and designs. I mean, I've got this packet that I flip through with my clients now, and I've been doing it for the last 3 or 4 clients, and I've just really kind of given them the design concept in it's really just 6 pages of information. And it's like, holy cow, it changes exact everything they learned and everything they thought of, they knew in that 6 pages. I can change your entire perspective on how you do layout and design. And again, it's revolutionary. I mean, I'm literally changing the entire design. Like anything you watch, any Sturgis video, any of those, like, they're fine. It's good information. I can blow those out of the water in 6 pages. You never have to watch a YouTube video again, and you're moving on. It's like, wow. And Thomas and I are working, when he gets back from vacation, we're working on brand new design concepts no one has ever seen in the industry. And the intention there is to be more, I want to say the right word is complex, but I want to be more intentional and mindful of what the environment needs. And so how do we create these systems that people can understand in a visual that are going to be well attuned and formidable in the sense that people will get it. And it's hard to get people to get it because I'm always fighting, the marketing campaigns and the other things that people have mislearned. And I'm like, okay, if I could do that, Men in Black, where I just, zap your mind and your mind's erased and I can start over with you, I'm going to have some really successful clients in hard to hunt areas. And I keep telling people, I'll do a run out in the Midwest with the folks in Ohio and some of those states. Not this year, because I'm doing everything pretty much in the North. Well, that's not totally true. I'm mostly in the Northeast. We would blow their minds coming out in the Midwest. And I think I'd be reluctant to hire people that do this because of the lack of sophistication. And I'm sorry, but that's my opinion on it. And I don't know everything. I'm just going to abbreviate. I don't know everything, but I am very, very attuned with what is needed in the industry. And I want to meet the man where he needs to be met. And I want to make sure when they design, they're thinking about vegetation, soil, and water management. And those 3 things are the primaries. And then this whole genetic expression, epigenetics, nutritional-based systems that build better quality deer, that goes into the equation. Everyone's worried about genetics and age. And I said, everything starts with the nutrition. A good quality foundation, like, hey, your feet underneath you. If you don't have good nutrition, your forefathers, forefather, they procreated. Their level of opportunity as it relates to having, successful broods or successful offspring, us, we generated from thousands and thousands and thousands of lineage before us, in that the strongest survive. What we're doing now is promoting the weak. And on the landscape, that's a problem. And
we're selecting for non-desirable traits. So we're exterminating deer with large antlers. So we're selecting to not have large antlers in many ways.
And you know what it is? It's called not the regenerative process. It's the degenerative process.
Degenerative. Yeah.
And so that's where I'm kind of like, oh my God, there's this great opportunity. And these mass populations of deer that are being mismanaged, and I'll fix the deer herd. I can't hear that one more time. I'll fix the deer herd. You're in an opportune location to fix the deer herd. And you're just a little microcosm, like your story today kind of proved that. And, I God bless you for wanting to do that and having the knowledge to do that. I mean, that's a big piece of this.
I appreciate that. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, when we're changing the herd, it starts with fetal programming. Your buck's never going to reach his true potential if the mother doesn't, right? And that's where fungi really come in, because mushrooms give them everything that you're trying to give to a deer in a mineral or a feed ration, you know, that's nutritionally dense, is available in fungi in those exact ratios. All those minerals are imitating mushrooms. That's it, pure and simple, right? And so when we put an unlimited buffet of mushrooms via the mushroom food plot right in front of them, now we've got this bastion of fungal, you know, food in the right times of the year when antler genesis is going on. And I've proven this. Undoubtedly, there's a chemical smoking gun called ergothione, which is a collagen precursor. The only other place a deer can get that is from soybeans or beans in general. And there's only a fraction of what in mushrooms, there's a lot. And in beans, there's very little, but there's some, right? That has been tested in the velvet of a deer while growing antlers and has been found there, but it's not found in the body blood at all, right? And so I'm the first person that I'm pretty sure in the entire deer industry that said, boom, this is how we grow antlers, and the science supports it 100%. You know, same thing with the mother, and this supports lactation. If you're a doe nursing fawn, you need a lot of calories.
Yeah.
Right? But more importantly, you need a lot of phosphorus and calcium in that 2-to-1 ratio. You need vitamin D. The only foodborne source of vitamin D that a white-tailed deer gets is from fungi, period. That's it. Unless they're eating snakes or some bird that fell out of a nest, which is an amazing anomaly that happens occasionally, right? They're just not getting it. They get some from sitting in the sun in their switchgrass bedding that everyone's in love with, but not that much, right? The velvet does absorb some vitamin D from the sun in that regard, but not that much.
Yeah, that's so. Go ahead.
So when we get them, you know, a belly full of mushrooms, that that drives the phosphorus and the skeletal mineralization process, where they pull phosphorus and calcium from the skeleton to build antlers or support lactation. And then they feast on fungi the whole year to replenish that, so to speak, right? And so when we look at it like that, and we realize that white-tailed deer are preferential mycophagists, meaning that they prefer to eat fungi first, and that they have to eat some low-quality plants to compensate for the high-quality forage that they're eating when they're eating fungi, then when we see them eating low-quality forages the rest of the time in a fungally devoid environment, and we're growing all these pretty crops, patting ourselves on the back, how messed up it is to do that.
Extremely. And I think it is a foundational thing. And we talked a little bit about, you know, non-producing, we'll just say, you know, mushroom, you know, fungal connections within the soil break. I think one of the more important things to recognize, and I think John Kemp said this on the podcast, and I really kind of value his opinion, is some of these elements that are within mushrooms specifically, you know, they could be the resource, but also kind of the facilitators of these health components. They are driving.
Yeah. Oh, they're 100% are. When we look at browse, let's just look at browse of plants. First of all, if you take a popular, you know, whatever popular plant, you pick one, and you say, okay, this plant's really good for deer when they eat it. Well, now let's slice that open and look in a microscope. It is a skeletal system of fungi with plant cells in between. And especially when we get to the growing points of the plant, we know that the deer really love those young leaves or the buds are a mineral stump. Well, those are like warehouses of fungi that have all those nutrients stashed there in those little fungal warehouses to begin building that part of the plant as soon as the bud breaks, for example, right?
Yeah.
And so it's the fungi. When you talk about mineral stumps, it's not the damn tree. It's not the damn plant. It's the fungi inside of it. It's called endophytic fungi,
yeah,
right? And when a deer nibbles on one plant and then goes over and nibbles on the other, it communicates and spreads those endophytic fungi via their saliva,
yeah,
right? And so we're building biodiversity by attracting them to the property, pumping their bellies full of mushrooms, and supporting those plants to grow to their very best. And in return, those endophytic fungi that support them inside of that browse, you know, they're spreading it around. So we're improving not just our property, but the properties around us.
Man, I have another a question for you. Just this is a pondering question that I don't know. I fully appreciate the answer to. You know, there was this study done several years ago. It was a Harper study, and you know, hey, fertilizer doesn't produce a better outcome for these well-established trees that are producing acorns that are, again, we're talking about fungal communities that are well-established and adding, you know, granular fertilizer to them and not getting a reward, so to speak. Again, there's variability environments which affect the trees.
Here's what's going on there. When you fertilize mushrooms, right? Let's say a mushroom food plot, you go throw some 2020 on it, right? 2020 on it. Well, it's going to, there's a few things going on. One, it's going to break it down and it's going to trade it with the environment around it. So when you fertilize your field, for example, with 2020, but it's surrounded by trees, what's generally happening is most of that is getting shuttled into the surrounding carbon bank to be stored. And then as the plants in that field produce sugars, it's being returned. So you get this long train of moving stuff back and forth. Right. And that's what's going on. Think about how much energy it would take for you to, you know, basically break. Let's call that fertilizer a battleship. We bring this battleship into our, you know, dry dock or whatever, and we tear it down into little pieces. And then from that scrap metal, we make 1,000 other products. Right. Or let's say that we just tear that battleship down to nothing. And then we build a brand new one later on. Right. Think about how much time and energy all of that takes and how you have to use resources. You know, food, water, shelter, you know, labor, all these things to accomplish that. Well, that's generally what's going on with these fertilizer related issues with these larger trees is that, you're dropping it there, but that tree can only use so much.
Yeah.
And those plants can only use so much in that readily available farm. So most of the time, these are either washing out because a lot of it goes in runoff. You know, this is why we get phosphorus blooms and algae blooms on lakes is because of this overuse of fertilizer. But if it's not seeping or running off, then it's getting shuttled to the nearby carbon bank, more or less to be stored until it's needed.
Yeah, one of the things I was kind of just thinking about, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think a lot of times people are promoting, you know, nitrogen. And I've recognized this tremendously, is the volume of nitrate that's in the soil directly correlates with weed competition, which is a problem. Particularly pigweed in a lot of areas that I've worked in. So keep adding your nitrogen, guys. That's, you're going to create more bacterial environments and therefore create more weeds. Isn't that funny? But I was thinking about this particular issue, and I think Harper's a really smart guy, but I think there's instability that comes with adding fertilizers to a fungal network. And maybe I'm wrong in that, but
you're not. You're perfectly right.
Okay. And so the benefit of potentially doing that is offset by the negatives. And so there's really no net gain. Where you may be more beneficial to is, and they realize this, I think, later on, and this is the evolution, I think, of their thinking, is just providing more sunlight. But if you manage that tree earlier in the phase rather than later in the phase, so when it's in that, you know, 20 to 30 age year growth stage, you may even have better outcomes. So the point I'm trying to make is if you get into your forest stand and you're starting to make some tree selections, like Matt was talking about earlier, and you see this like really good species of plants, you're starting to get to that phase out stage where trees are phasing out other trees. You can select a tree, an individual tree, promote it, you know, giving it the most sun availability and creating, you know, a canopy or an opportunity for a canopy that's large and diverse where it will be able to maximize later on down the road, maybe not even in your lifetime, its fungal network as a result of its overstory development. And
go ahead.
No, that's my,
you know what mother tree is?
Yes.
You ever heard the phrase mother tree?
Yes,
that's exactly what we're talking about here. You're creating a mother tree, which is a mothering influence on the plants and the trees around them. So if one of them gets sick, it can communicate, you know, via its fungal network in this immense reservoir of different fungi and other bacterium. It can communicate those literally to that. Here's some medicine. If it gets afflicted by one disease, you know, it can literally help that. It will help that tree. And it will also give strength. We'll say that there's young seedlings coming up near it. Well, it will pick and choose which ones get fed. And so the long term, there is an overcrowding issue.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah,
exactly. So I think there's a better outcome based upon a different strategy, and you'd rather do that earlier than later in the process. And I think that's why these trees on the edges of fields tend to do so well. Another thing I just observed the other day was, and I was talking to a client about this, is there is some networking amongst oak trees and chestnut trees, because the trees that I've planted near the oak trees that were resident that are in that like 40 to 50 year old range and adjacent, I've got hybridized chestnuts. Those have grown like tenfold as compared to the trees that are completely separate from those networks. And there's if you saw the difference. And again, the trees that are next to the oaks have less sun, and they are way taller and way more broad and beautiful looking specimens. Whereas the trees that have direct sun, that are completely separated, that are in the same exact soil, it's managed exactly the same way. The difference is uncanny. It's amazing, the difference. And again, this boils down to these communities within the soil that are creating these opportunities for trees to develop into these very healthy specimens. And I'm just amazed by that. That's an observation, but it's cool, right? I mean, Matt, isn't that cool? I think that's cool.
It's amazing. It's amazing that all these years later, the chestnut's been gone for, you know, let's say 100 years-ish, depending on where you live. It could be less, it could be more, right? But the forest still remembers that the chestnut is an integral part of that relationship. And it likely still remembers that that tree attracts herbivores, and the herbivores, via their scat, when they come in, deposit fungal diversity and other bacteriums and things like that, as well as the nutritional load of the scat. And then also, of course, those herbivores and other, you know, like squirrels and such, they disperse the seeds. So it still remembers the mutualism.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to kind of characterize it. But it is interesting. Hey, look, this is one of the longest podcasts I've done. So we got to get to the end of this, because I always promise the listeners, we won't go on and on. But I appreciate this conversation. This is, we didn't have any plan for this other than talk about your property. Let's talk a little bit. Just want to finish up here at the end, so people, you know who you are, know what your product is, and are able to contact you, because I know you've got kind of a new product coming out, kind of an improved product, and I think people will much appreciate that.
Yeah. So my name is Matt Williams. I run Mycohabitat. Mycohabitat is a fungal first. I call it fungi centrism. I had to invent a word to describe it. So fungal centric, meaning that we take that as our base level and we look at the fungi first before we do anything habitat wise, wherever applicable. And then, of course, I also sell mushroom spawn. I'm the purveyor of mushroom food plots for white-tailed deer. Now, I have been working with a known set of genetics from our previous farm that was okay, but somewhere in the move, things kind of got mixed up, and I had two of the same type of mushrooms. So it'd be like having two of the two phenotypes or strains of the same kind of corn, so to speak. Well, what happened was, and the one that I've been selling the last year and a half, it works okay. It produces mushrooms. It makes great soil, John. You know all about it. But this other one that I've had for many years and used is way better, and it produces a lot more prolifically and a lot more frequently. And it is a more dynamic soil maker, meaning it just happens faster, right? And for whatever reason, the deer seem to really crush this one. Well, as sometimes things happen, you get a mix up. And the way that works is it takes over, 6 months to a year for you to see the results, depending on the site and everything and how you did it, from the time you plant it till the time you see what comes up with the fungi. And so last year in the summer, I was like, wait, this isn't the right, variety, so to speak. So I had to retool and basically throw everything out and start over from scratch in my laboratory, and brings us to our current situation where we've got the original strain is. So when you're watching our videos, I call them card pool videos, where we take the SD card out and show you the mushroom food plot over the last few years, that's what you're watching, is that variety. And we call that variety the Redstones. And that's the only variety I'm running in my lab or at the farm right now. So there's no more mix-ups ever. But long story short, yeah, that variety, the Redstones of Strafferia, or the winecap mushroom, is what we sell. And then I sell several different sizes of that based on your needs. It could be, a package of 50 pounds, which covers 500 to 1,000 square feet, depending on how you assemble it, or a package as small as 5 pounds, which covers 50 to 100 square feet, depending on your application rate, right? And so basically we take lignin, cellulose, which is straw and wood chips or sawdust or shredded leaves, any of those compost brown items, that you would put in a compost pile that's, you know, not green. So no hay, no, what do you call it? The grass clippings, any of that, but compost browns. And we basically grow mushrooms with it. And we do so with the focus on wildlife in particular. And it's not just white-tailed deer that eat this. So you're going to see pretty much every critter that lives on your property. I've had quite a few bear visits in the last few years to these sites. Usually a mama bear with cubs, but I've got this huge bruin in the neighborhood that comes through every once in a while as well. And then I see, I think I've seen everything that lives on the property there at one point or the other. A lot of songbirds come in and they, or turkeys and grouse, and they'll pick apart the mushrooms and they'll eat the mushrooms, but they'll also eat the bugs and the salamanders and the frogs and the little snakes and the slugs and all these other things. And if you boil it down, basically what we're doing is we're taking one of those giant logs that's the start of the food web, you know, and we're mulching it up, so to speak. So, you know, when you look at a forest ecosystem, it all kind of starts with rotting wood. All those little insects feed on it, on the mycelium, and then the things feed on the insects, and the things feed on the things that feed on the insects. Or the, you know, the, instead of it being mycelium, it produces a fruiting body of, or a mushroom as we think of it, and it eats that. So what we're doing is we're just jump starting that, so to speak.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And a quick question I have for you, I'm creating a lot of different things, but one of the things that I have kind of laid out throughout my property is, and particularly on my north slopes, is I do have wood chips laid out. You can see the mycelium. I mean, there is an idea where I want to take that material that I've created as it's been decomposing in those particular areas, and there's been some mushroom production, and I want to transplant it to another cool area around some of my other tree species that I'm trying to promote on the edges of the drip line. Does that make a lot of sense to you? Because that was one of my...
Here's one thing I would do to even go one further with that, John. If you've got the deer coming in and other animals and they're eating it and you've got free access to more wood chips, sawdust, stuff like that, instead of taking, you know, let's say you make a mushroom food plot, deer come in, they eat it for a year or whatever, and then instead of grabbing that and running off and making a new bed with it, put more wood chips and sawdust all over the top of that. That way all that scat that's been dropped there with all those different fungal spores and species begins to germinate as well. So now you've got a ton of fungal biodiversity. And then as that grows and develops, you now have, you know, breadth throughout the season where you've got early stuff, late stuff, mainstay stuff. And then when you spread that around, you're getting so much more.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay.
I call that process naturalization. If you just went and dumped a whole bunch of wood chips on the ground, it really wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't do anything like what we're trying to do here. Right. So we're using the Stropharia as our targeted species to jumpstart everything.
Yeah.
And then we throw everything else on top of it. Yeah, we're still going to get some of the Stropharia mushroom or the wine cap mushroom that I call the redstone growing on it. But what we're also going to get is get all those other saprophytes, or that's fancy words for things that eat dead wood, basically. We'll get them going as well. And now we've got these mushrooms that occur later in the season and earlier in the season. And then when we disperse that, now we've got this fungal diversity that we're spreading. So, you know, I'm growing a 150 fruit trees from seed right now for my kids that have been eating fruit all winter. We've just been saving the seeds. Well, when we put those out, I'll do you know what a wattle is? Basically, when you stick sticks in the ground, then you kind of weave like a basket brush around them, you know? So when we go out and we put those, we call them wattle cages, instead of using a metal cage that we have to buy, we're just making them out of those sticks. When we put those wattle sticks in there, when we transplant those seedlings, we're using that naturalized bed or plot that we made for mushrooms. We're using that to put around it. You know, we're not making the volcano, you know, all the things they tell you not to do, but we're just putting a nice little 3-foot circle of wood chips, you know, around it or whatever. But we're inoculating that, so to speak, by using the existing bed, just exactly what you described.
Yeah. No, Matt, real quick, and I want to kind of end this pretty soon, but you mentioned the wattle and dead hedging is another option that people use. Can you explain what species you use to kind of create that structure?
Sure. Ironwood's amazing because it lasts forever, and it's really, especially when it's green and pliable and fresh cut. But willow is very popular. Maple works great as well. You want to have something that doesn't rot real fast. So like basswood, box elder, probably not a good choice, you know, because those are lighter woods and they dry rot fast, or standing rot fast. And so you're just kind of looking for those kind of materials that stand up a little longer in the landscape, but also are pliable and soft enough that you can work with them. And if they dry out a little bit, you can always soak them, you know, in a creek or a lake or whatever overnight to work with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's basically like basket weaving, only you're, you know, using, you make fences out of it. We're making a garden fence here at the house with it. It makes beautiful little fences.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay, good. I think people can, you know, there's a lot of good ideas in this podcast today where people can think differently about some other tools or techniques that they can add to the landscape. Just last thing, your website, how do people find you?
Myco-habitat.com or on Facebook, Myco Habitat. Myco is Latin for mushroom, M-Y-C-O, habitat, like the spaces we occupy. It's kind of like a hidden double entendre there because it is, in fact, my cohabitat as well. We cohabitate these spaces with the wildlife that we love. You know, if I'm not shooting the biggest buck of my lifetime, the second best thing is watching the Nature Channel to me. I want it to be like a show, Wild America episode, every time I'm out there. That's what I'm after when I'm doing habitat work.
Man, and I love the way you describe your property with all these zones and, you know, the different things you're working on, whether it's maple syrup or mushrooming or gardening or what have you. You've just got multiple uses for this property, and it's just not a deer hunting property, right? That just makes the story that much better. And I think if people thought about that and in my designs, right, we're talking about nurseries, water management, all those things, you know, there's income to be generated too, right?
And you got it. That's the point. We, you know, we do some farmers market stuff and we make some money off of it. But at the same time, did you really just buy, you know, how many ever hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property and go through all this stuff just to tiptoe around it for a month a year? Are you kidding me? I'm not doing that.
No.
You know, I'm going to hunt it, and I'm going to look, I take hunting very seriously. But at the same time, you know, my family and us using it in a responsible manner is pretty paramount for us. We're not ripping through there with four-wheelers or letting the dogs run loose or any crazy stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that's good. You're not running around in crazy outfits and scaring off animals and all that kind of stuff. That makes sense. Matt, thank you for the time today. This is the longest podcast that I've done, so congratulations to you for winning the record. And I knew you were going to be, we were going to be long-winded today. I just had a gut feeling. So thanks for taking time out of your day for me. I appreciate you. I appreciate the willingness to share. There's tons of good information in here. You might want to listen to this again. I think there's a lot of good things to consider. And you know, Matt, really, you know, being a contributor here to the podcast, I appreciate you. You should co-host with me a couple times, and we should, that would be fun. I think that would be fun.
Just appreciate you, whether it's just, you know, sending a message and kind of bouncing ideas back and forth, or you having me on,
yep,
whatever it may be. And if anybody's listening once or twice to this, and they're in the upper Midwest, and they're looking for someone to, you know, to do some consultant work for them, or perhaps help them with their property, well, they can feel free to look me up.
Yep, absolutely. All right, Matt. Well, thanks for the time, and I will talk to you again soon. See you, man.
All right. Later.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.